Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we are talking about The Brothers Karamazov, Book 11, Chapter 8, Part 2. I'm not paying attention, I should pay attention. We're talking about Book 11, Chapter 8, Part 2, then we'll be reading Book 11, Chapter 9, Part 1. We are only reading the first half of Chapter 9 because it is, again, quite long. And this being a long weekend in Australia, it's a long weekend. I don't have a whole lot of time up my sleeves because I've got a lot of other things on. Anyway, we're doing the first half. How can Ivan prove Smurdy's guilt? And what does Ivan's efforts with the peasant at the end of the chapter prove? Swim said the Mama Fishy said, I took a break from the Brothers Karamazov after Book 9 and Dmitri's Wild Ride. These people had just become too exhausting to spend time with, so anywho, a lazy and very hot weekend here in the American Southwest, I caught up. Awesome. Hey, you know, I love hearing about where people are from. The big observation I have is that reading a chapter or half chapter a day is that I at least get embroiled with can't see the forest for the trees. At least get embroiled. What does embroiled mean? Involve someone deeply in an argument or conflict. Ah, yeah. With the can't see the forest for the trees. The second is, apart from the Book 10 interlude, is these people are still exhausting. So, big picture. Back to Book 10. I enjoyed Kolya, but then I'm the mother of three boys, now men, and also got themselves in a fair amount of trouble back in the day. It's too bad Dostoevsky did not get the chance to complete Alyosha's story. I believe Kolya would have played a prominent part based on this line. Either we will once become friends for the rest of our lives, or we will turn our backs on each other and be enemies until the grave. I would have liked to see Kolya grow up and see how he turned out, and Alyosha too. He is so young as well. Yep. It's funny about Alyosha, because, I don't know, he spent so much time setting him up that he's like the main character of the book. It felt like for the first like half of the book. And now he's sort of like just like a side character. Strange, structurally. Regarding Book 11, Dostoevsky was so matter-of-fact about Lisa's self-harming. 21st century sensibilities, it was jarring. Also interesting was Ratikin working for the 19th century tabloids. Good to keep in mind that this type of rag has been around forever. It appears that Smerdyakov's big argument is, you wanted your father dead, so I killed him, and you didn't like your brother, so I pinned it on him, and I got money too, so yay me. And by the way, I'm smarter than all of you. But I think he has found out that you can't intellectualize murder, and most likely parricide, since he is physically declining. Blaming Ivan helps assuage the guilt he is feeling. Ivan has been given a wake-up call that his ivory tower didn't protect him from the real world, after all. He felt so chastened, and off-kilter, he helped the peasant.
Chastened.
As far as proving Smerdyakov's guilt, it won't happen. The authorities have spent time, money, and resources on the Dmitri prosecution. It would be political suicide for them to change horses midstream. At least in America, and considering all the forensics we have available, it is still extremely difficult to change prosecutorial minds. Of course, Drama Llama Dmitri didn't help himself. Soma Stars said, regarding the getting embroiled in the chapters because of the slow pace and can't see the forest for the trees type thing, I've been struggling with this too. I've read ahead in chunks, which makes the book feel more cohesive and understandable. But then I lose out on the discussions that happen here about each chapter, because I can't always recall the little things from each chapter. Both the chunk reading and the daily discussions have benefits, and it's hard to choose one over the other. Yeah, we do get bogged down in the finer details when we read so slowly and with such thorough discussion about every chapter. It's not the way that books were really, I suppose, intended to be read. They're sort of meant to be... you're meant to allow them to sort of wash over you, in a way. Rather than like getting bogged down and in all the nitty gritty. But still, it also, yeah, like it's rewarding in that at the end of reading the book, when you do it in this way, and I really found this with War and Peace, is that you really feel like you've experienced it on a deeper level than otherwise. I Am Norwegian said, we have been discussing a couple of Hermann Hesse books over at r/Hermann Hesse. We started out with Demian and moved on to Goldman and Narcissus. I just finished the latter a few minutes ago. I'd like to jump over on Hermann Hesse and participate with you guys over there. In fact, I'm going to subscribe right now. But my... Oh, wait, I've already subscribed. There you go. My issue is that I don't have much time to read another book. And so as much as I want to read these books, they're on the list. But I will join you guys there in some discussions at some point. Okay. I Am Norwegian continued. You talking about Hermann Hesse on the podcast today reminded me that you spoke of him earlier in the podcast too, because I knew who he was. His books are very special, seemingly following the same blueprint of a young man in search of spiritual development, combined with Jungian-inspired rants about the nature of things from characters that possess incredible insight. I will say that reading Hesse was a nice break from the Brothers Karamazov, especially with the beautiful prose. Hesse is great. I don't know if you've gotten to Steppenwolf yet, but that's one of my favourite books. And I haven't read that much Hermann Hesse. I've only read two books by Hermann Hesse. Which was Steppenwolf, which I loved, and probably not even half of Siddhartha. I didn't get through it. And I really didn't like that one. And you know, the thing that put me off is someone said to me once, and it stuck with me, that Steppenwolf is like his worst book, and people who are Hermann Hesse fans typically are fans of all of his work except for Steppenwolf. But I really love Steppenwolf, so I just had it in my head that I probably wouldn't like his other books. And then because I'd gone ahead and checked out his most popular book, being Siddhartha, and not liked it, I just kind of assumed, oh, okay, well, that kind of validates that theory that I just sort of seem to like that one outlier book of his that... I've said that to a few other people, and they've sort of been like, I don't know what you're talking about. All these books are great. Steppenwolf's a great one. So I think I just had the wrong idea. It put in my head, and I took whoever said that, I can't even remember, someone put that idea in my head, and I just took their word for it. So anyway, my point is to say I'm definitely looking to read some more Hermann Hesse in the near future. Edit says, I Am Norwegian. I also liked what you said about human truth. I'm not going to copy Pacey's speech warning Alyosha against cruel analysis again, but I think it makes it clear that Dosko is not trying to make an epistemological case based on pure reason and logic. When you do that, you lose the human truth. This distinction is a constant theme in Hesse's books too. Oh, very cool. Hey, thanks for saying you liked what I said about human truth. I think there's... it's a really handy way to look at the world, that little theory of human truth versus scientific truth, and the human lens versus the scientific lens, and how both of them are true to us because we are humans. All that. I said it much more articulately yesterday, but it does help you reconcile, because... You people often think, oh, well, there can only be truth or false. Like, there's no other thing. But it is a good model that you can use to reconcile that there are different versions of truth, and both are equally true, but they're also different. Question one. How can Ivan prove Smurdy's guilt? I Am Norwegian said, I don't think he can. It all would all be hearsay. Grigory, imagining himself... to having seen the door open, is the final nail in the coffin. Plus, Smurdy did have a legitimate seizure later, which makes it look like he's always told the truth. He even ran back to his bed before Martha woke up. Unless Smurdy confesses, nothing is going to change. Question two, what does Ivan's effort with the peasant at the end prove? I think being confronted with Smurdy and with his own wish for the death of his father and his influence over Smurdy has awakened something in him. He has decided to do the right thing tomorrow, and that desire is expressing itself in his altruism towards the peasant also. He is planning on doing the right thing even when it is going to cost him dearly, and he will gain nothing from it. We haven't seen Ivan do something like that before. another edit, listening to the podcast, I realized that Techrific made a good point drawing in the commentary on rational utopianism that exists in Notes, especially considering how right Dosto turned out to be. Everything did turn out to be permitted in the march towards utopia. Techrific said, the clash of those ideas and their offspring certainly changed the face of the world. Thinking of all the revolutions, two world wars, the rise and fall of communism and fascism, not to mention Dosto's psychological insight, this might be his worst written book, prose-wise, style-wise, but it's a hell of a book in its content and scope about the human predicament. We have to grant him that at least, whatever else we may say about him. Yeah, I've probably been a bit unkind. Well, I've been very, very unkind in my critique of this book, and you're probably quite right about the deeper points that he's making with this. I do think a lot of it comes down to the translation that I'm reading. I reckon they could make a slightly abridged translation, which is just clean up that prose a little bit so it's not so clunky. You could have a hell of a book. You really could. I'm just reminded, sorry, the reason I just got absent-minded as I was talking is because I think there was a comment yesterday which led me to believe in yesterday's conversation that someone was going to go back to dig up some information and come back. And I remember thinking, oh, wow, okay. Oh my gosh. All right. Sorry. You guys have no idea what I'm oh my goshing about. So what I've just gone and done is gone and revisited yesterday's conversation. I've gone back a day. And just to try to find that bit where someone said, I'll look something up and then I'll come back. My point is the conversation from yesterday has grown dramatically since I did the podcast. There's a lot more conversation. And I'm not able to find the bit. Oh, actually, I do. I have found it. I've only heard one convincing answer to the theodicy problem, but I can't remember where it was. I know by who, so I'll try to find it. I won't try to make the argument being unable to do it justice. That was I Am Norwegian. But you haven't gone back and posted it in there, so all that was for nothing. I'm sorry. The podcast just slowed down to a probably unbearable slow pace there for a minute. Anyway, sorry, I was reminded of that. Yesterday when I read that comment, I'm like, ooh, I should check back to see if he finds that thing and check in. Okay, where were we? I Am Norwegian says, I agree. If nobody has said that the book is badly written, I would not have noticed it. I still don't notice it when I'm reading it. I have never read any of the other Russian authors that are often mentioned alongside Dosto, so I have little to compare him to. But as you say, the scope and insight is very impressive, and that was always what I wanted from this book. Techrific said, comparing him to Bulgakov, Tolstoy, Gogol, and Pushkin, I think the consensus among the Russians is that Dosto is the worst language-wise. Even in Russian, his prose is awkward and clunky and repetitive. I think Avsey mentions these problems in his foreword. So in that sense, Dosto is not a complete writer in the sense that all the parts form a harmonious whole. Gogol, Pushkin, and Tolstoy are more complete authors in that sense. As far as novels go, I still think War and Peace is the greatest novel ever written. Wow, Tech, I did not know that. I didn't know that you considered it that. It is a great book. Prose-wise, if we're talking Russians, I haven't read Bulgakov, Gogol, or Pushkin, so I can't really comment there. Who wrote Lolita? Lolita. Three little syllables, roll off the tongue, etc. Nabokov. Right, that prose is slick. Like, that prose is just absolutely beautiful. Just complete polar opposite ends of the scale from someone like Dosto, where the prose is so clunky and ugly. And then Tolstoy is pretty middle of the line. It's clean prose. It's very easy to read. There are a lot of very long sentences, but that you forgive that after a while because it just becomes sort of natural. And even with those really long sentences, it's still quite readable. it's easy to interpret. But Dosto, yeah, Dosto is an absolute mess. Here in this, here's a 21st century pop culture article that supports War and Peace being the greatest novel ever argument. At a minimum, it birthed the sweeping family saga genre, which I myself am internally grateful for. That was a comment by Swim, said the Mama Fish, referring to a Huffington Post article called Seven Reasons You Should Give War and Peace a Chance. I won't read the article, but I'll read the headings of those seven reasons. It's a mirror of our time. It's a riveting history lesson. It'll help you understand Russia today. It's one of the wisest self-help books you will ever read. It's an engrossing read. You'll get to know a lot of fascinating people. And reason number seven, it will make you feel better about being alive. I would agree with most of those things. Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone's arguing that War and Peace is a great book. It's a long book, though. It's an epic, right? And the genre epic is such a thing. You live with an epic book. You live and breathe it. It becomes part of you for a little while. You become part of that world for a little while. With all the length of Dostoevsky's this book, The Brothers Karamazov, it doesn't feel like an epic. Like, we're not living and breathing and seeing people be born and grow up and get married and die and go to war and come back from war and go into debt and then repay debt and be tricked and gamble away their life and be captured and taken prisoner. And like, War and Peace just goes over like sort of generations, and you live and breathe and you live and die with these characters. And but this one, it's 700 pages, but it exists over the space of about 3 days or something, it feels like. So it's a different beast. Epic doesn't just mean the length of the book, I think it means like the scope. Okay, Uncle Josimo said, here we have again the neural predicament of the novel. If God doesn't exist, everything is permitted. It seems that Dostoevsky is saying to us, these are the consequences of to think like that. Murder, robbery, innocent people condemned to jail, suffering, frustrated love. I just disagree on such a core level with that statement of, if God doesn't exist, everything is permitted. Like, the only reason you don't go around murdering is because God might punish you. That's so juvenile. I can't believe that people grow up into full-grown adults still with that mindset. It's just beyond me. Maybe an intellectual mind can play with the idea of all possible scenarios this argument can lead us to, but an unscrupulous and unstable mind wouldn't entertain philosophical digressions and would set the world on fire without thinking twice. This question is similar to the Euthyphro dilemma. Very controversial in its time. In Plato's dialogue, Euthyphro, Socrates puts in question the moral itself. Is the moral good because it comes from the gods, or is it good in itself without any need of gods? Sorry, gods. In other words, something is good because God commands it that way. Moral depends on God's arbitration, or God commands something because it is right in itself. Moral is independent of God. This question gave many headaches to erudite minds along centuries. Jeez. Who discussed if God is the source of all moral, or if he is not. Ivan goes further and questions God's ethics in his conversation with Alyosha. Dosto shared with us his dilemma and shows us the consequences of thinking like that in the end. He also gave us as awesome as preachers promoting love and compassion. Laura Weistich said, I don't think Ivan can prove Smurdy's guilt. All he has is his account and the money, which could have come from anywhere. The bigger question is, will he tell the prosecutor? He starts thinking he's a good person, he helps the peasant, and considers going to the prosecutor in that moment. Then he decides to do it tomorrow, at which point he suddenly seems less sure about it because of something against the wall. What could that be? Tekrovic said, in my translation he's looking at Divin, but is he seeing something else? Maybe he's starting to go a little loopy. He's feverish and plagued by guilt. Maybe he's seeing the ghost of his father. A Divin is a long, low sofa without a back or arms, typically placed against a wall. All right. Ready to go on? I hope you are. We're going to continue now and read the first half of chapter 9, which is called The Devil, Ivan's Nightmare. I am not a doctor, but yet I feel that the moment has come when I must inevitably give the reader some account of the nature of Ivan's illness. Anticipating events, I can say at least one thing. He was at that moment on the very eve of an attack of brain fever. Though his health had long been affected, it had offered a stubborn resistance to the fever, which in the end gained complete mastery over it. Though I know nothing of medicine, I venture to hazard the suggestion that he really had, perhaps by a terrible effort of will, succeeded in delaying the attack for a time, hoping, of course, to check it completely. He knew that he was unwell, but he loathed the thought of being ill at that fatal time, at the approaching crisis in his life, when he needed to have all his wits about him, to say that what he had to say boldly and resolutely, and to justify himself to himself. He had, however, consulted the new doctor, who had been brought from Moscow by a fantastic notion of Katerina Ivanovna's, to which I have referred already. After listening to him and examining him to the doctor came to the conclusion that he was actually suffering from some disorder of the brain and was not at all surprised by an admission which Ivan had reluctantly made to him. Hallucinations are quite likely in your condition, the doctor opined, though it would be better to verify them. You must take steps at once without a moment's delay or things will go badly for you. But Ivan did not follow the judicious advice and did not take to his bed to be nursed. I am walking about, I am strong enough. If I drop, it will be different then. Anyone may nurse me who likes, he decided, dismissing the subject. And so he was sitting, almost conscious himself of his delirium, and, as I have said already, looking persistently at some object on the sofa against the opposite wall. Someone appeared to be sitting there, though goodness knows how he came in, for he had not been in the room when Ivan came into it. On his return from Smerdyakov, this was a person, or, more accurately speaking, a Russian gentleman of a particular kind, no longer young, qui face la cinque quarantaine, 50-ish, as the French say, with rather long, still thick, dark hair, slightly streaked with grey, and a small pointed beard. He was wearing a brownish reefer jacket, rather shabby, evidently made by a good tailor, though, and of a fashion at least 3 years old, that had been discarded by smart and well-to-do people for the last 2 years. His linen and his long scarf-like necktie were all such as were worn by people who aimed at being stylish, but on closer inspection his linen was not over-clean and his wide scarf was very threadbare. The visitor's check trousers were of excellent cut, but were too light in colour and too tight for the present fashion. His soft, fluffy white hat was out of keeping with the season. In brief, there was every appearance of gentility, of straitened means. It looked as though the gentleman belonged to that class of idle landowners who used to flourish in the times of serfdom. He had mistakenly been at some time in good and fashionable society, had once had good connections, had possibly preserved them indeed, but after a gay youth becoming gradually impoverished on the pollution of freedom, he had sunk into the position of a poor relation of the best class, wandering from one good old friend to another, and received by them for his companionable and accommodating disposition, and as being, after all, a gentleman who could be asked to sit down with anyone, though of course not in a place of honour. Such gentlemen of accommodating temper and dependent position, who can tell a story, take a hand at cards, and who have a distant aversion for any duties that may be forced upon them, are usually solitary creatures, either bachelors or widowers. Sometimes they have children, but if so, the children are always being brought up at a distance at some aunt's, to whom these gentlemen never allude in good society, seeming ashamed of that relationship. They gradually lose sight of their children altogether, though at intervals they receive a birthday or Christmas letter from them, and sometimes even answer it. The countenance of the unexpected visitor was not so much good-natured as accommodating and ready to assume any amiable expression of occasion might rise. He had no watch, but he had a tortoiseshell lorgnette on a black ribbon. On the middle finger of his right hand was a massive gold ring with a cheap opal stone in it. Ivan was angrily silent and would not begin the conversation. The visitor waited and sat exactly like a poor relation who had come down from his room to keep his host company at tea, and was discreetly silent, seeing that his host was frowning and preoccupied, but he was ready for any affable conversation as soon as his host should begin it. All at once his face expressed a sudden solicitude. "I say," he began to Ivan, "excuse me, I only mention it to remind you. You went to Smerdyakov's to find out about Katerina Ivanovna, but you came away without finding out anything about her. You probably forgot." "Ah, yes," broke from Ivan, and his face grew gloomy with uneasiness. Yes, I had forgotten. But it doesn't matter now. Never mind. Till tomorrow, he muttered to himself. And you, he added, addressing his visitor, I should have remembered that myself in a minute, for that was just what was tormenting me. Why do you interfere as if I should believe that you prompted me, and that I didn't remember it of myself? Don't believe it then, said the gentleman, smiling amicably. What's the good of believing against your will? Besides, proofs are no help to believing, especially material proofs. Thomas believed, not because he saw Christ risen, but because he wanted to believe before he saw them. Look at the spiritualists, for instance. I am very fond of them. Only fancy, they imagine that they are serving the cause of religion because the devils show them their horns from the other world. That, they say, is a material proof, so to speak, of the existence of another world. The other world and material proofs, what next? And if you come to that, does proving there's a devil prove that there's a God? I want to join an idealist society. I lead the opposition in it. I'll say I'm a realist, but not a materialist, hee hee. Listen, Ivan suddenly got up from the table. I seem to be delirious. I am delirious, in fact. Talk any nonsense you like, I don't care. You won't drive me to fury, as you did last time, but I feel somehow ashamed. I want to walk about the room. I sometimes don't see you and don't even hear your voice as I did last time. But I always guess what you are prating on, what you are prating. For it's I myself speaking, not you. Only I don't know whether I was dreaming last time or whether I really saw you. I'll wet a towel and put it on my head, and perhaps you'll vanish into air. Ivan went into the corner, took a towel, and did as he said, and with a wet towel on his head began walking up and down the room. I'm so glad you treat me so familiarly, the visitor began. Fool, laughed Ivan. Do you suppose I should stand on ceremony with you? I am in good spirits now, though I have a pain in my forehead and in the top of my head. Only please don't talk philosophy, as you did last time. If you can't take yourself off, talk of something amusing. Talk gossip. You're a poor relation. You ought to talk gossip. What a nightmare to have, but I am not afraid of you. I'll get the better of you. I won't be taken to a madhouse. C'est charmant, poor relation. Yes, I am in my natural shape, for what am I on earth but a poor relation? By the way, I am listening to you, and I am rather surprised to find you are actually beginning to take me for something real, not simply your fancy, as you persisted in declaring last time. Never for 1 minute have I taken you for reality, Ivan cried with a sort of fury. You are a lie, you are my illness, you are a phantom. It's only that I don't know how to destroy you, and I see I must suffer for a time. You are my hallucination. You are the incarnation of myself, but only of one side of me, of my thoughts and feelings, but only the nastiest and stupidest of them. From that point of view, you might be of interest to me, if only I had time to waste on you. Excuse me, I'll catch you. When you flew out at Alyosha under the lamppost this evening and shouted to him, you learnt it from him. How do you know that he visits me? You were thinking of me then. So, for one brief moment, you did believe me, that I really exist. The gentleman laughed blandly. Yes, that was a moment of weakness, but I couldn't believe in you. I don't know whether I was asleep or awake last time. Perhaps I was only dreaming then and didn't see you really at all. And why were you so surly with Alyosha just now? He is a dear. I've treated him badly over Father Zossima. Don't talk of Alyosha. How dare you, you flunky? Ivan laughed again. You scold me, but you laugh. That's a good sign. But you are ever so much more polite than you were last time, and I know why. That great resolution of yours. Don't speak of my resolution, cried Ivan savagely. I understand. C'est noble, c'est charmant. You are going to defend your brother and sacrifice yourself. C'est chevalesque. Hold your tongue, I'll kick you. I shan't be altogether. Oh. Sorry, for some reason, my window just changed on my computer. I shan't be altogether sorry, for then my object will be attained. If you kick me, you must believe in my reality, for people don't kick ghosts. Joking apart, it doesn't matter to me. Scold if you like, though it's better to be a trifle more polite, even to me. Fool, flunky, what words? Oh, gosh. Excuse me. Scolding you, I scold myself, Ivan laughed again. You are myself, only with a different face. You just say what I am thinking, and are incapable of saying anything new. If I am like you in my way of thinking, it's all to my credit, the gentleman declared with delicacy and dignity. You choose out only my worst thoughts, and what's more, the stupid ones. You are stupid and vulgar. You are awfully stupid. No, I can't put up with you. What am I to do? What am I to do? Ivan said through his clenched teeth. My dear friend, above all things, I want to behave like a gentleman and be recognized as such, the visitor began in an access of deprecating and simple-hearted pride, typical of a poor relation. I am poor, but I won't say very honest, but it's an axiom generally accepted in society that I am a fallen angel. I certainly can't conceive how I can ever have been an angel. If I ever was, it must have been so long ago that there's no harm in forgetting it. Now I only prize the reputation of being a gentlemanly person and live as I can, trying to make myself agreeable. I love men genuinely. I've been greatly calumniated. Here, when I stay with you from time to time, my friend, my life gains a kind of reality, and that's what I like most of all. You see, like you, I suffer from the fantastic, and so I love the realism of Earth. Here with you, everything is circumscribed. Here, all of the formulated and geometrical, while we have nothing but indeterminate equations. I wonder about here dreaming. I like dreaming. Besides, on Earth, I become superstitious. Please don't laugh. That's just what I like, to become superstitious. I adopt all your habits here. I've grown fond of going to the public baths. Would you believe it? And I go to steam myself with merchants and priests. What I dream of is becoming incarnate once and for all and irrevocably in the form of some merchant's wife weighing 18 stone and of believing all she believes. My ideal is to go to the church and offer a candle in simple-hearted faith. Upon my word, then there would be an end to my suffering. I like being doctored, too. In the spring there was an outbreak of smallpox and I went and was vaccinated in a foundling hospital. If only you knew how I enjoyed myself that day. I subscribed 10 rubles in that case to the Slavs. But you are not listening. Do you know you are not at all well this evening? I know you went yesterday to that doctor. Well, what happened? What about your health? What did the doctor say? Fool, Ivan snapped out. But you are clever anyway. You are scolding again. I didn't ask out of sympathy. You need an answer. Now rheumatism has come in again. Fool, repeated Ivan. You keep saying the same thing, but I had such an attack of rheumatism last year that I remember it to this day. The devil have rheumatism. Why not? If I sometimes put on fleshy form, I put on fleshy form and take the consequences. Satan sumet nihil humanum e me anim loputo. I am Satan and deem nothing human alien to me. What's Satan sum et nihilum humanum? That's not bad for the devil. I am glad I've pleased you at least. But you didn't get that from me, Ivan stopped suddenly, seeming struck. That never entered my head. That's strange. C'est du nouveau et c'est et pas. It's new, isn't it? This time I'll act honestly and explain to you. Listen. In dreams, and especially in nightmares from indigestion or anything, a man sees sometimes such artistic visions, such complex and real actuality, such events, even a whole world of events, woven into such a plot, with such unexpected details from the most exalted matters to the last button on a cuff, as I swear Leo Tolstoy has never invented. Yet such dreams are sometimes seen not by writers, but by the most ordinary people, officials, journalists, priests. The subject is a complete enigma. A statesman confessed to me, indeed, that all his best ideas came to him when he was asleep. Well, that's how it is now. Though I am your hallucination, yet just as a nightmare, I say original things which had not entered your head before, so I don't repeat your ideas, yet I am only your nightmare, nothing more. All right. We're going to stop there for today. Interesting. Ivan seems to be having a conversation with an hallucination. All right. Have your say about this over at the Reddit. Thank you for listening today, and I'll see you tomorrow.